Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Good Morning Pride. My name is Eric Schlitt, and with me today, Jeremy Reisman, the producer at Pride of Detroit. It's been a little bit of time since we've last talked, but I believe you were my last guest on the Good Morning Pride episode that we did. I think you were
Oh.
episode 10. This is episode 11. So
There
look at
you go.
that. It's like a recurring guest
I'm a recurring guest on your podcast now. Am I on the call sheet?
Well, I tell you, the podcast, the Detroit Lions Breakdown podcast and Good Morning Pride, we've been a little slow time of the year and whatnot. We've talked about that. Joe and I have talked about that and how I've been a little tied up, but I promised people that we would try and get more episodes back. I promised them you. I don't know if you knew that. I promised that I would have you on, so I didn't want
Is
to let
that
people
why the
down.
bad reviews started to come in?
No, I think
Threw
that
me a
was
line.
after. I think yeah, I think I promised them you so that they would stop. No, from real from a serious standpoint, I, because of my schedule, was not able to get to OTAs or minicamp in the spring, and you were, and you wrote a lot of good articles on it, and I think most people that probably listen have already consumed those. But I wanted to give people another auditory form of content surrounding not just OTAs and minicamp, but just other things in general. So a little over a week ago, I made a call for questions to the mailbag. Very high response, a lot of volume to those questions, a lot of really good questions. And so I've kind of basically picked through them, and I put a couple aside to write articles about, which I've already started doing. I pulled a couple aside for me and Joe, and I figured there was a couple that would be relevant to your knowledge that I didn't get a chance to see. So I thought, hey, what a great opportunity to ask some questions. And then I picked some other topics I just thought would be fun to talk about as well.
I
So,
was going to say, when you said you pulled a couple of questions, you mean a couple dozen.
no, well, I tell you, when I asked for questions, I think I got 58 questions. Now, and that's I'm sorry, 58 responses. Some of those responses had
People like
multiple questions as
to
well.
they like to
Yes.
fit in, use all
Oh
however
yeah.
many characters you can have on Twitter these days.
100%. So, it took me 4 pages. I typed them out and like I copy and pasted them onto like a Word document, and
Yeah.
it's 4 pages long. So, a lot of content, a lot of information people want to know. And one of the things I try to do is answer them all. But I realized very quickly I wasn't going to be able to answer them all in like one sitting or even two sittings. So that's why I've tried doing this in multiple platforms. So, all
And
right.
I also want the people to know that you've
Yes.
literally printed out these questions.
Oh, yeah, for
They
sure.
are
Old
not on a computer
school.
screen. They are
No, no, no,
physically in
no.
your hands.
Yeah, because, look, I originally, originally, I had opened up like three different Word documents because I was going to have one for me and you, one for me and Joe, and then one for the Pride of Detroit website. And then I was like, but I'm also organizing them by category, right? So I didn't trying to organize them by category and then platform just became a little cumbersome. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to put them all together, print them out old school, and then I'll just go through and sort them as I read them. So that's
Bump the font up to 40-ish.
I'm not that bad, but I definitely yes. The font needs to be a little larger because the glasses the prescription on the glasses is getting thicker every year. That's just the price you pay
Right,
of
I'll stop
getting old.
busting your chops. We can start talking about the lines.
Oh no, I understand. All right, so let's sort through some things here, and let's start by talking about maybe some coaches. Our coaches, like questions surrounding coaches. One of the first ones that I wrote at the top was from a question from Shad. It's, we often hear about how much Ben Johnson has helped Jared Goff, but how come we don't hear as much about how Mark Brunell's efforts? So Mark Brunell, is he getting enough love if he, it, or, you know, why aren't we talking about him as much as we should? What's he doing? Why is he, what's he doing to help Jared Goff?
It's hard to say, right? A lot of times it's really hard for me to parse through what position coaches do because we don't see it, right? A lot of the work they do is behind the scenes. A lot of the work they do is in the meeting rooms. The work that they do on the field that we see, we're not actually hearing the conversations.
Right.
I think a lot of times we judge position coaches based on their media sessions. And like part of that, it makes sense, right? Like they're standing there, they're showing their presence. Yep. They're communicating, which is a big part of coaching. And so that's why we gravitate towards guys like Kelvin Shepherd. Like he's really good in front of the podium. So we know he can communicate well with his players. Now, I'm not going to say Mark Brunell is bad in front of the press. He's not, but like you can tell it's obviously not a high priority on his list of things to do. He doesn't give out a lot of information. Sure. You know,
and we don't get him often either.
And we don't get him often.
Yeah. Right.
That is a fair point to make. Now, that being said, you're absolutely right. I think he should be getting more credit.
Yes.
I think Jared Goff also doesn't get enough credit for his improvement, right? I think
sure,
the
sure.
national media tends to just be like, wow, Ben Johnson is making Jared Goff a good quarterback, and that's it. And I think that's a little bit silly. And I think you have to give Jared Goff the credit for making the effort, improving in certain areas. And I think the other thing is like, particularly nationally, people aren't actually seeing the improvement. They're seeing the stats improve, but like Jared Goff isn't a flashy quarterback. So they're not like, wow, he must be getting coached really well because he's making all these crazy throws. He's not doing that. He's just like, he's really good on the fundamentals. I think he's really improved in his pocket presence the most. And that's where I do give position coaches a lot of credit. Cause that is like a direct result. That's not schematic. That's not coming. Like Ben Johnson isn't pulling Jared Goff aside and saying like, you need to work on your footwork better. Like that is directly Ben Johnson, or that's directly Mark Brunell, and probably a little bit of JT Barrett too, if we're being quite honest. Like he's part of those conversations too. So I don't know. It's really tough to me when we get into these like position coach conversations, because it's hard to assess how they're doing when you don't see exactly what they're doing and you don't know the actual talent level of some of your players. Like sometimes we'll get into these conversations and be like, man, you know, the cornerback room, it's been horrible. This is why they've been firing all these cornerback coaches. Well, is that the case, or is like Jeff Okuda just not as good and all that sort of stuff? But I'm rambling a little bit, but I think I agree with the question here that Mark Brunell deserves a lot of credit, but at the same time, it's hard to know how much to credit him for this improvement because there are so many different factors that we're just not privy to.
Yeah, like when we do see Mark Brunell, like in the Lions, like behind the scenes stuff, it's usually him joking around and, you know, having a good time. It's not like you're not getting any of the nuance of what he's doing. I do think though, the fact that Mark Brunell had a quarterback underneath him get a job as a quarterback's coach in David Blau, I think speaks to Mark Brunell's ability to, you know, communicate what it takes to be a good coach, because not only is he are the quarterbacks in his room getting better, but they're also turning into other quarterback coaches. And so I think that's a nice feather in Mark Brunell's cap. I do agree that Ben Johnson gets the majority of the credit, and he's the hot name. So it's always, you know, it makes sense for the national media to go that route. For example, on NFL Network the other day, they had dark horse candidates for MVP in 2024, and Jared Goff's name came up. And almost the first thing that they said was, man, Jared Goff has a really good chance to be successful. You know, Ben Johnson's coming back. And it was, you know what I mean? Like, it was like, it's right. Like almost immediately. Right. But I think that's just like that it's that inherent nature of the national media to go towards the name, you know, the hot name. And, you know, Jared Goff has always had kind of that stigma on him. And so it's easy to say, well, the reason he's good is because of Ben Johnson. But at the same time, you don't pay him the money that you paid him if unless you think he can do it without Ben Johnson. So,
right.
Yeah. But Brunell definitely, you know, he probably deserves a little bit more love. The hard part is just, like you said, we don't have the access. So it's hard for us to really put a thumb on why, what he is doing that is, you know, showing up on film other than just asking like Jared Goff. Okay. All right. Next question. This one gets a little trickier. This is from Mike K. He wants to know, did Green Bay and Chicago successfully download, quote, the Ben Johnson offense in the second half of last year? And then there's a follow-up to that as well. So let's start with that. Do you think that Green Bay and Chicago, who both won, there's or no, I'm sorry, Chicago didn't. Did they? No, Chicago didn't. They Go ahead.
Won what?
Did they win again? The Chicago didn't beat Detroit.
They split.
Was it the second time that they won?
Yeah.
I thought Detroit won. Okay.
Detroit won at home with that crazy comeback. And then a couple of weeks later, Chicago won in Chicago.
You know what? I'm getting my thoughts back to 2021 because that's really, you know, one of my favorites. Okay. So Chicago and Green Bay both won their second meetings. And so was it familiarity with Ben Johnson's scheme, or do you think like they just were a good team at the right time that happened to pick up on the offense? Which one do you think? Do you think they just figured them out?
No, I don't. I think those teams just got better as the season went on. I think Chicago's defense got really good towards the end of last year. Both those teams are relatively young, particularly on defense. Green Bay is probably even younger on offense than they are on defense, but they're young teams that just like that. We saw it with the Lions over 2 years. Your favorite season, 2021, right? Same with 2022. It's sometimes, particularly when you have young teams, that first month of the season is hard. It's just hard. It's new players. It's a new scheme. It's getting back into the swing of things. It's not veteran guys that know how to treat their offense or their off season to hit the ground running. And so I think those teams just naturally got better, which is why both those teams are going into 2024 with a lot of confidence. You could say, you know, they have more familiarity with Ben Johnson and maybe they started to figure some things out. Maybe there's a little bit of truth to that, but that would also presume that Ben Johnson is standing still, which he's not. He's changing and developing things and developing more plays and throwing more looks out there. And I don't think anything Ben Johnson is doing is revolutionary in a way that he's been figured out or I don't think any offensive coordinator is at a level where they can't be quote unquote figured out necessarily, but it's just a matter of like going out there and beating it and continuing to evolve on both sides of the ball. So like it, to me, it's always a cat and mouse type of game where it's like, you think you've caught up to someone, but then they change something. And so,
sure.
I don't know. I think there's this misconception that you can figure a person out or figure an offense out or figure out a defense. I think in general, it's just, you get better defensively, you get better offensively, and suddenly you play better. And so I don't have the Chicago Bears' defensive stats in front of me, but I know they got significantly better in the second half of the season. And I think that's what we witnessed.
Well, yeah, they also had a lot of turnovers, right? Like they were able to get pressure, which was, right. Cause you know, I think if you look at the fact that they also played Tampa twice and Tampa gave up 31 points to them the second time that they played the Lions now, and Todd Bowles is one of the, you know, he's one of the better defensive minds in the game. And so, but that's the second half of Mike's question is, did you notice that maybe they made any tweaks down the stretch or more specifically like in the playoffs? Cause I don't think I noticed anything that was more, that was like a diversion from what he's been doing. It was more of a building process, right? It was more like, I've shown you this, and now I'm going to layer, I'm going to uncover more layers to it, right? And so I think Ben's scheme is good in the fact that it allows him options on how to alter it for his opponent, right? Like, there's not all offense in the NFL is you have a lot of the same plays, and yes, there's wrinkles and there's trick plays and there's stuff like that here and there, but like a lot of it is commonplace. Like, there's a lot of basic concepts that transfer between schemes, and but with Ben, it's about calling them at the right time, knowing when you're setting things up, and then coming back and then showing new wrinkles that maybe you didn't show previously. And I felt like Ben did that a lot more in the playoffs, which is what made the Lions offense hum a little bit better in the postseason.
Yeah, I think all that is definitely fair. I was going to add something else, but I don't remember. So,
all right, well, let me ask his third part to this one question is, do you have any concerns for this upcoming season about maybe people figuring out what Ben is doing?
No. And I think it's just what I said before, like Ben mm-hmm. Johnson is constantly evolving. He doesn't strike me as the kind of person that's like, okay, well, we have our offense set. We can just kind of like hum on what works for us. Now there are certain tendencies, right, that I think mm-hmm. Ben Johnson has that maybe people will be a little bit wiser to. I think maybe teams are going to be a little bit more cautious when it's 3rd and 5
mm-hmm.
and knowing that Ben Johnson is crazy enough to run the ball.
What about running the ball on 4th and 5 like he did in against right. the Chargers?
I think maybe teams get a little bit wiser to that, but that only sure. plays to the Lions' strength, right? Like if they're a little bit more unpredictable, or you know, they could run it on 3rd and 6, they could run it on 4th and 5.
Mm-hmm.
That's just gonna like keep the defense guessing more than anything else. Like that's what makes the success of that 4th and 5 play crazy and crazy good. You know, every other team saw that. And you know, mm-hmm. every other team is now whispering to their defense, like, hey, don't sell out on the pass here.
Mm-hmm.
They might run it. And when that happens, it becomes harder for defenses.
Yes.
The offense becomes more unpredictable. And so, yes, you know that the Lions have some of these tendencies. You know, when they are in a 3rd and medium to short and on the opponent's side of the field, they could very well run it because they're going to go for it on 4th down. Right. But that doesn't make it easier to stop it because they could still pass it too.
Yeah, the construction of the roster to give them the weapons that they have that complement each other and help each other get open, or you know, help create a lighter box. It's really neat to see how it's come together, and I think it's something that does not concern me moving forward. I think they have enough wrinkles and enough really good players at good spots that you combine that with Ben's evolving scheme, and I there's no reason for concern for me either.
Yeah. The only thing I'd add there is that we know that the Lions do a significant amount of self-scout, right?
We
even, you know, heard Ben Johnson talk about it a little bit over the spring when someone had asked him about the third quarter woes. He came in and he already had like the stats in his back pocket. Like, first 10 games of the season, we did not score once on the first possession.
Pause.
Yeah.
Jack Franny wants to know the consistency of our poor third quarters last season points to a deficiency in making halftime adjustments. Do you have any sense on how the coaching staff may improve this season? So I'm sorry, continue.
Yeah. because Ben Johnson was asked that. Yeah. He had the stats in his back pocket. I double checked them and even dug a little deeper. And because he said, you know, we had no touchdowns on our first drive of the third quarter. In the first 10 games, we had 5 in our last 10 games. So half the time coming out of the second half, the offense scored a touchdown going from whatever that is, week 12 to through the playoffs, including the playoffs. Mm-hmm. I dug a little deeper, and they actually scored 0 points in those first 10 weeks on the opening drive of the second half. 0 points, no touchdowns, no field goals either. I think they had like three turnovers, three and outs. Like it was really bad. Now,
let me pause you. Let me pause you real fast. They averaged 4.1 points in the third quarter on the season.
Yeah.
And the other quarters, they averaged 6.1, 6.7, 7.2. So yeah. Go ahead, continue.
And I mean, listen, the back half was better. Knowing Ben Johnson, he's still probably not happy with it, right? Scoring a touchdown on half of your opening drives in the back half of the in the second half, good, but not good enough because there were also three and outs. So five touchdowns, three and outs, and two something else. That's not good enough. Three and outs, I have to imagine is driving him crazy, especially like if that's coming off the back end of your defense allowing a touchdown, like you're suddenly your defense is going to get more tired in the second half. And so the big question is, it's twofold. What did they do to improve offensively, and how are they going to improve this offseason? And unfortunately, I don't really have the answer to any of those, but I think you can at least be a little bit encouraged that they pulled out of like a tailspin from that first 10 games and got better at it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think them taking the ball first, wanting the ball first so that they don't have to come out on offense coming out of the half, do you think that was a factor? Or do you think they took the ball first because they wanted to put their offense on the field first?
It's a good question.
I think it's the latter, personally.
Maybe. I'd be interested to look at the splits. Like, when did they change that decision compared to when did we see the turnaround in the second half? I don't know that offhand, but
yeah, I don't either. It just occurred to me.
Yeah, the other thing that I think, because anytime you ask a coach about halftime adjustments, they all say the same thing. If I was going to make adjustments, why would I wait until halftime?
Right.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think in general, like we all tend to think, you know, whether it's from movies or TV shows, that like all of halftime is spent with the coach crowded around the team and saying, this is what we're going to do. Like that's most of the time they're just relaxing. Like they're letting their bodies reset. They're going to the bathroom. They're stretching. Right. Like there's coaching happening, but it's not like this big, all right, this is what we're going to do. We're going to change everything. Now, if you want to argue that the Lions are just not, they're not adjusting their coaching throughout the game, period. I think that might be a valid argument to talk about, and maybe in-game adjustments rather than calling them halftime adjustments is something that needs to be addressed, that needs to get better. But it's hard to know exactly what that is when they're just coming out flat out of halftime. Maybe.
Yeah.
I think Dan Campbell's asked us at one point, like, are you guys going to change what you do at halftime? Like just, and he said, no, like, I don't think there's anything in that process that is causing this problem.
All right, let's shift to another one. All right, well, let's shift away from coaches for a minute. Let's grab another training camp question. I haven't got to the OTAs yet. We'll get to those at some point. Okay, these are just general questions. This is from Ed Helinski. What position battle will be the most competitive during training camp? So we've got a lot of, you know, I think for the most part, a lot of the starting roles are solidified, especially on offense. There's like one starting job open on offense. On defense,
yeah,
you could argue, you know, certain things. It's hard to tell because of injury, exactly what the Lions plan is or what, but so what's the, I'm just going to make you pick one. What do you think would be the most competitive position battle during training camp?
Competitive to me means that there's going to be a lot of talent. I mean, you could take it another way, just meaning it's a lot of people on the same level, and then maybe like wide receiver three would be an interesting battle because it doesn't have a clear winner right now, a clear leader, I would say. And so maybe that would be the most competitive. But I'm going to take this question more so as a lot of good players, not a lot of open spots. And I'm going to kind of cheat and encompass all cornerbacks, both nickel and outside cornerback. And I think I can do that fairly without cheating because there are a couple players that could fit in either competition.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Now, do I think the starting lineup is relatively set in my mind, or at least will be set? Yeah, I think it's going to be Carlton Davis and Terry and Arnold on the outside and either Brian Branch or Meek Robertson in the nickel. And I mean, maybe even Ennis Rakestraw. He might compete for the nickel job. Sounds like they're at least going to try him out there a bunch. But to me, there's just, I don't want to forget about Emmanuel Moseley. I don't want to count out Ennis Rakestraw, maybe on the outside, maybe at the nickel. I don't want to count out Amik Robertson winning a starting job. I don't want to count out Brian Branch playing safety, or maybe they try him at safety and they realize, nah, we like him at nickel better. Like, they're going to find out all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, Dan Campbell even said it, like, he has no idea what the starting lineup is going to be. And I think maybe he's embellishing a little bit, but I think there are so many different outcomes in terms of nickel, in terms of outside, in terms of safety, that I think that's going to be a very fun position to watch during training camp to see how much it all shifts from what we think we know right now.
Yeah, I'm going to go with your first gut, which is outside receiver, and say, like, I expect that one to be the position where we don't really know who's going to emerge, or if there even is going to be like just one guy, or if it's going to be a collection of guys. But the receiver, I expect that battle to be one where we might be changing our opinions weekly or even daily, right? Yeah. And so to me, that is competition. I think there's, you know, is it going to be Antoine Green that steps up? Does Don Peoples Jones, are they leaning more towards Khalif Raymond and his reliability? Like, or will there be a surprise Caden Davis introduced into the mix, right? Like, you know, who could
it be? Williams.
Grace Fountain, right? Like, who knows, right? Yeah. And so for me, I think that's going to be competitive. Maybe not as like elite of talent, but it's a role that they're going to need. And I'm interested to see, you know, how that shakes out. So then to flip it, from Keen Observations, he asks, which position do you think is the biggest concern after OTAs and mini camp? So heading into training camp, which position are you the most concerned about? Now, he gives you options if you want to think mm-hmm. about, or you can go off script here as well. His positions that he is most concerned about are depth at safety, the starting X wide receiver X, offensive tackle 3 or quarterback 2 or dealer's choice.
Yeah, I mean, the first two were the two that jumped to mind first, which is safety and the X receiver spot. I keep kind of going back and forth with the X receiver thing. Like, part of me is like, they have so many other options.
Sure.
It's not going to be that big of a deal.
Wide receiver 3 is probably target 6 in the pecking order, right? You know what I mean?
If you're including running, correct?
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, okay. Yeah. Sorry. Is
weapon 3.
Weapon 6. Weapon 6. Wide right. receiver yeah. 3 is weapon 6, right? Like, yeah. Maybe 7. It might be weapon 7, to be honest. But let's just say 6 for argument's sake.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, I wonder how big of a role it's going to be. But
at the same time,
I'm going to let you go. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, if they find one guy to fill that role, they're still going to be mm-hmm. on the field like 70% of the time.
Sure.
Like, it's a big rep role, mm-hmm. even if he's not seeing the targets. And so that means that person is also going to have to do a lot of the stuff away from the ball that's important to what they do. They're going to have to block well. They're going to have to, you know, clear out space for the other guys well. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to be precise with their routes. And just because they're not getting the target share, I think a lot of people look at what Josh Reynolds did in terms of targets, in terms of statistics, and say, like, oh, that's not that hard to replace. But what they loved about that guy so much was all the stuff he did away from the ball too. And so mm-hmm. it might not seem that important to you because he's not catching footballs and that's what wide receivers are generally paid to do. But for a team that likes to run the ball so much, for a team that is so dependent on precision from every single person on the field, if you run the run the wrong route and you're not involved in the play, that can still mess up the play. Mm-hmm. And so they need someone they can trust at that position. And I don't know who that is yet. And so no one really stuck out to me during minicamp or OTAs. Granted, a lot of my observations were production-based. None of them, I did not see them make a lot of catches with the first team. It seemed like a lot of JMO. It seemed like a lot of Amon-Ra. It seemed a lot of Sam Laporta. And so production-wise, haven't seen a ton. But again, you can gain faith in ways that aren't production-based. And then to move to like safeties, a lot depends on what they plan with Brian Branch. Like if their three are Fatu Melifanu, Kirby Joseph, and Brian Branch, I'm fine with that. You throw in CJ Moore and
Brandon Joseph.
I don't know, Brandon Joseph probably. Like that's not a bad room.
Mm-mm.
And I think
it's better than I think most people think.
Yeah. Now you're also depending on a lot. You know Kirby had an up and down year last year. If he's only played 6 or 7 games as a starter, Brian Branch has played 0 as a starter at safety. So that's very much on paper in an okay looking room, not necessarily in practice yet. But if that's the plan, like I think that might be the best utilization of their defensive backs, because I do think they have options at nickel outside of Brian Branch. I do think they have enough people on the outside. And so generally speaking, I think it could very much work in the safety room, as long as Brian Branch has that bigger role at safety that some of us are projecting him to have. So I think I still do go back to that wide receiver X role, even though you don't need 700, 800 yards from that player. You do need someone you can trust because he's going to be out there a lot.
We're going to get back to receiver in a second. For me, just to put a cap on this, I would swap out safety depth for OT3. OT3 is a bit of a concern for me.
For you.
It is. It really is. It's one of the in the mailbag that I wrote today, I said, for those of you who have listened to my ramblings over the years, OT3 has always been a position that I think you need a capable starter at. And right now, I think the Lions are hoping that's Colby Sorestal. And I like Colby. Colby's is great. Can he be a capable starter if you need him to be? I don't know. He's going to have a lot of chances to prove to me that he can be. I like him as a developmental player. I liked how he was progressing at guard. Tackle is more natural to him. I don't think I'm comfortable with Dan Skipper, and I think he is what he is. He's kind of maxed out, whereas I think Colby's still sending. I don't think Manu is going to be ready. And so you have two unbelievable starters at tackle. After that, you've got an unproven second year player that you're pushing back to a spot that he hasn't played only played sporadically over the past year. So I'm a little concerned about that. I feel much more comfortable at safety with Branch, with them indicating Branch is going to be back there a lot more. All right. So, but I'm with you on receiver, which brings us to our next question. This is from Sean Petkoff. Fun fact, Sean is the brother of my former neighbor. Hey. So, hey, Sean, how's it going? Sean wants to know, are we likely to see more of Antoine Green this year? Is there a lot of promise in his development to fill in for Josh Reynolds?
Well, I'll tell you what, one of the bigger surprises from minicamp was that he was repping ahead of Donovan Peoples-Jones when both of them were healthy. The way the Lions tend to operate, they tend to put veterans ahead of young players this early in camp. And so the fact that when Antoine Green was healthy this spring, he was regularly repping with the ones, to me is notable. It doesn't mean the job is his. It doesn't mean he took the opportunity and ran with it, but it means the Lions are giving him pretty much the biggest opportunity to win that job. Mm-hmm. And that to me speaks quite a bit. They talked him up a little bit in the offseason as well. So I think it's certainly possible. Like it's very much possible that he wins that wide receiver 3 role. I personally had kind of etched in Donovan Peoples-Jones as my early offseason pick to win that job. Mm-hmm. But I think it's, I think the spring kind of proved to me that this, that is much more of an even matchup than I expected as we head into training camp.
Just to, for perspective, for people who maybe, you know, don't know a whole ton about Antoine Green. If you compare him to Donovan Peoples-Jones, Peoples-Jones is 6'1 and 5'8". Antoine Green is 6'1 and 6'8". They're both around 200 pounds. Donovan Peoples-Jones ran a 4.48, and Antoine Green ran a 4.48. Actually, 4.47 officially. Their speed scores are basically just over 100. Their vertical jumps, the nod goes to Peoples-Jones, but in the agility, you tend to see more with Antoine Green. But they're basically very close physically to the same player. Peoples-Jones has a lot more experience. He's put up a 600 yard season in the past, which is,
I think, right? We cobbled over this one time and I keep forgetting.
I will take your word for it. I might be thinking 600 because that's what Josh Reynolds had last year. Right. And so,
yeah, 839.
So he's got some experience and they are stylistically somewhat similar. They're probably both best set as like kind of like field stretchers, but their bodies are big enough that they can go over the middle as well, which allows them to play the X role in Ben Johnson's scheme. So I think it'd be a nice competition between the two of them. And, you know, Green used to be like, he was Drake May's favorite target a year ago, you know, or a year and a half ago. And so, and he had huge production downfield. Like one of his best traits coming out of college was that he had a very, very high yards per catch rate. And so that kind of fits in with Josh Reynolds. Remember, like Josh Reynolds, like the first six games, like every catch was a first down or a touchdown, right? Like everyone, like for six games, or maybe it was more. But that's the type of thing, like stylistically, he's even Josh Reynolds was more better vertical threat than, but he was a bigger body who had good routes. And so for Green, it's all about route running. It's all about, like, that was something that held him back. They didn't feel like he was as precise in his route running, but even like last year in training camp, like he was coming along for a while and then he made a couple mistakes and then he got dropped down and then he had a hard time working his way back up again. But this is a guy that was on the roster all year. Didn't get a ton of opportunities because it was a deep room, but it's not as deep of a room this year. And, you know, if Brad Holmes drafts you, it's for a reason, right? They don't just throw darts at a wall and hope that those draft picks, you know, stick. Every draft pick that Brad Holmes has made the roster except one, RAP Chase Lucas. And so I do think he's absolutely going to get a shot. And it sure sounds like he was getting it in OTAs. I expect him to get it more in training camp as well. All right.
And I think really quick, I think the midseason addition of Donovan Peoples-Jones proved that Antoine Green wasn't ready for the bigger role at that point.
Yes.
But that does not mean that he hasn't made strides since then, right? He's a much younger player.
Yes.
They believed him. He stayed on the roster the entire season. And even though they made the decision to re-sign Donovan Peoples-Jones, I don't think that necessarily is saying like, oh, we don't believe in Antoine Green. You're allowed to have 90 guys right now. Why not have that competition play out?
Sticking with wide receiver. Well, okay. Ash Soden. He asked us to talk more about the X spot. He's basically saying, who do we favor between the candidates that are out there? And he asked for kind of strengths and weaknesses, but we kind of went over that a little bit. Do you have a favorite between Green, Peoples-Jones, Jarees Fountain, who I'm also kind of putting over in the X competition in my mind?
Sure.
And then he included Caden Davis. I kind of envisioned Davis more like a Z, but again, I'm not going to rule him out because I think he had a good spring from what I heard as well.
Right. I kind of like bringing Darius Fountain into the conversation a little bit because he shows a lot of agility out there. Like you'll mm-hmm. see in training camp, that guy is like leaping up for every pass he can possibly get his mitts on. Like he has I don't know what his actual vertical is, but his play vertical looks very nice. I don't know if that's an actual term that people use. We talk about play speed versus actual speed. His play vertical, decent. Very good.
Vertical 42.5 is pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah, the average wide receiver vertical is around 35. Okay. So
checks out.
Yeah, 7 inches more. He's the second highest vertical of the wide receivers.
Okay.
So So I'm gonna pause you here for a second because I want to get thoughts from my couch's attention because he says Ben Johnson brought up a wide receiver on the scout team multiple times this spring, saying they might get contributions for them. Do you think he's bluffing, or who do you think he's talking about? He's talking about Darius Fountain, right? Like that Darius was the guy who was on the practice squad at the end of the year. And I think he's the guy that Ben is essentially alluding to. So go ahead. Let's go back to Ash's question and talk more about. So Fountain, is he legitimately in competition with Green and DPJ? I think he is, but you saw him. You saw him more in person. So interesting.
I would say he isn't yet, but he can make up ground. Because to me, like it still was clear, at least in terms of rep order, in terms of, you know, who Jared Goff is throwing to when they do, you know, individual drills, which mm-hmm. I know is something that you pay a lot of attention to. And I'm starting to pay a little bit more attention to. It's still very much Antoine Green, Khalif Raymond and Donovan Peoples Jones. Like Goff is going out of his way to make sure when he's throwing every route in the book and those guys come up in their rotation that he's throwing to those guys. I'm not sure he's thrown to Darius Fountain once. Like Darius Fountain, not repping with the first team yet. I will say he has become a little bit of a favorite target for Hendon Hooker. And like I said, all that can change, right? Mm-hmm. In an instant. They can mess with the order a little bit. You can see, I mean, I don't think Jared Goff is going to get a ton of preseason play, but maybe during the joint practices with the Giants, you just get those reps in to see what it looks like. But we know how important that kind of chemistry between Goff and the receivers are and how long sometimes it can take to develop it. And so that's why I'm not quite ready to put Darius Fountain into the competition yet. But among the reserves, I think he's one of the guys that stood out during OTAs.
I want to expand real quick on something that you mentioned. And you talked about the fact that he's not in Goff's rotation yet. For those of you who are going to training camp, when they're doing warmups with the like individual drills and they're having receivers run routes and the quarterbacks are throwing to them, what they will do is they will specifically stagger the receivers so that they match up with Goff. Okay. And Goff only throws to guys that he's going to be throwing to on a regular basis. So you'll often see like Goff throw like two passes in a row and then he'll step out for a pass and then he might just step right back in and throw. And that might be because of which wide receivers are up. And you'll notice he always throws to Amon-Ra. He always throws to Jameson. He always throws to Khalif. Those are the three guys and Josh Reynolds was the other guy. He always threw to those guys and individuals. So if you're at training camp and you're like watching warmups, pay attention to that because whoever Goff's throwing to is usually the guy. They do that for a reason. And so those little nuances will give you a lot of insight into how a player's doing. Because if all of a sudden now Jared Goff takes an extra rep and he starts throwing to you know, Tre'Quan Smith, you're like, all right, time to watch Tre'Quan today, right? Because there's something going on there that you need to pay attention to. And then they let the other quarterbacks throw to the other reserves. And so, okay. So if Fountain gets in that mix it's worth paying attention. I think, again, from a size standpoint, Fountain is right in that mix. 6'1 and a half, 206, runs a 4.5. So he's right along from a body standpoint, this in that same build as Peoples-Jones and Antoine Green. Was with the team at the end of last season, so he's got some familiarity with the scheme. I think he'll get a chance to compete. Doesn't sound like he's there just yet. Caden Davis is a guy who got a lot of attention, I think, in the spring, or at least from like the write-ups. Like, he seemed to stand out. You wrote about him a couple times. Do you have anything that you want, like, that you want to say about him, or anything that you want people to look for when they start paying attention to him in training camp?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing when you just look at him out there, the size difference is noticeable. He's still 6'1", but the Lions have him listed at 193 compared to Darius Fountain, who they have listed at 210. Like, that is immediately noticeable, which kind of makes it even more surprising, his performance, because a lot of his big plays were deep balls, deep contested catches, and he doesn't seem like the type that would necessarily fight for a pass and wrangle it away from a defender or anything like that. But he showed a little contested catch skills there, which was not something that I thought was in his wheelhouse. I don't think it's his superpower. I don't think that's what makes him a good receiver. But if he has that as well, I think that's maybe why he drew so much attention. Not only that he was making big plays, but he was doing it in a way that was surprising. And so, I mean, I tend to be very, very, very cautious with UDFAs, particularly when Caden Davis is repping with the second team and the third team, which means he's going up against second and third team defenders. But I mean, he's making the most of the opportunities that he has, and that tends to be rewarded with his coaching staff.
So he was a UDFA in 2022. So he's been leading the league a couple of years. My idea of him coming out was, I had him as a Z, which is the vertical outside, right? The Z with some slot range and some return ability. And so I think that is, I also had him listed at right around 6 foot. So maybe that 6'1" might be a little generous from the Lions there. Just, you know, maybe they're padding his numbers a little bit. Sure. Unless he grew, I mean, who knows? For me, I haven't seen him because I briefly watched a little bit of stuff a couple years ago, but I think he was in Denver, right? Or something like that. If I'm not mistaken, I forget exactly where.
Right.
Or Oakland, one of the two, somewhere out on the way.
AFC West teams.
Right. And so I didn't know much about him. And I, like I said, I didn't see him in the spring. So I wanted to hear what you thought about him before I got there. Okay.
Broncos, by the way.
Oh, okay. Right the first time. Should have just stopped while I was ahead. okay. I saved this one for you, not because I expect you to answer it, but just because I wanted to address it. Happy Drew Year asked how the trio of undrafted centers were doing in their competition. And I wanted to address this. Again, not because I know you love talking about reserve offensive linemen, but because I wanted to point out that they don't have pads on in OTAs. Yep. So we really don't know. Drew, you are speaking to my nature as an analyst to talk about third string centers, but we don't know right now. Or the only thing we really know is that they're cross training. Right. They're getting reps at center and they're getting reps at guard. That's about it. So unfortunately, we're kind of stuck there.
Right.
But go ahead.
Well, I was just, maybe this is where you're going to take it too, because we had talked earlier today about this, this notion that they bring in, I mean, it's certainly a unique and noteworthy thing to underline that the Lions bring in three backup centers on their UDFAs and be like, okay, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. I think we both agree. What that doesn't mean is that whoever wins that competition is making the roster and the backup center job.
Yes. I wrote about that today. Yeah. I essentially said, I'm expecting Frank Ragnow to be the starting center, Graham Glasgow to be the backup. And then the third center, which is a competition between the three UDFAs, and Michael Neese, who was the third center last year,
yep,
to basically be on the practice squad. And maybe two of them make the practice squad, but yep, maybe it's just one. I don't think I have a lean towards any of them. If you looked at the money, you'd say Kingsley. Ugakun is probably the front runner based solely on money, but you can't judge that too much with UDFAs. You got to see pads, right? You got to see him, yep, put on pads. You got to see him go up against other bodies. And to be honest, when those pads come on, they're going to be up against guys like Broderick Martin. And that's going to be a lot of fun to watch how that shakes out. Speaking of shaking, BK Shaky asks, how concerned are you with the offensive line depth? I'm going to let you go first. Offensive line depth, concerned, not concerned?
I would say moderately concerned. Not that the Lions are less prepared than any other team. I think we say it every year that good offensive linemen are a rare species. There's mm-hmm, just not a lot of good ones to go around. So if you have six, sure, or seven, you have a luxury that most teams don't have. My biggest concern, I would say, is just lack of experience, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. You know, Graham Glasgow entered last year as one of those guys that was very much a luxury. You know, he wasn't supposed to be a starter. He was supposed to be your first guy off the bench. He ended mm-hmm up having to take over, which is great. Problem is they don't have that this year. They don't have a guy like Graham Glasgow on the roster who, if anyone on the offensive line goes down, you can slide him in and be like, oh, this is a starting level player that slides, right, in. I mean, you could say they had that with Evan Brown a couple of years ago as well. They mm-hmm don't have that guy this year. They have guys that have played. They have, I think they like Coyote a lot. I think Natain Moody is a guy that I've been talking about a lot who also has a limited amount of experiences, but he's been in the league for 4 or 5 years. So knows how the game is played. Doesn't have a ton of starting experience, but it's there. And you mentioned it all the time. Like the backup tackle job is just, it's not there. I think I have a little bit more faith in Dan Skipper than you, but it's not like I have a ton of faith in him. I don't want to see him at left tackle. I don't want to see him at right tackle. I mean, I think part of the reason why it also feels like there's such a big step down for the next guy up is because the starters are so good. Yeah. You know, no one can play on Decker or Sewell's level because those guys are both way above average tackles. And in Sewell's case, maybe the best tackle in football. So
there's no maybe. He is.
Yeah, sure. But I guess
this is a Penesu is the best offensive lineman in the NFL podcast. So
I'm sorry. I didn't know the conditions of my appearance here.
Yeah.
But I guess the overall point being like the Lions are doing what they should be doing, which is starting to develop guys that they hope to become starters one day. The problem is I don't know if any of those guys are there yet. I don't know if Colby Sorsdahl is there yet. I'm pretty certain that you're not going to have Giovanni Manu in starting capable form at any point in 2024. Now, Christian Mahogany is a guy that I didn't mention that could have a quicker transition to being ready, but he's also a rookie. He's also a yep, fifth round pick, sixth round pick, whatever. So
scheme familiar though. That's that his, sure, his, the gap heavy scheme that BC runs is really going to help Mahogany transition to Lions scheme, I think, faster than it would if he was coming from like Manu's scheme or something like that.
Yeah. In general, do I think the Lions are in a much worse position than any other team in terms of the reserves? No, I don't. Mm-hmm. But because their offensive line is so important to what they do, mm-hmm, I would say maybe it is a little bit of a more heightened concern in Detroit than maybe it would be in other teams.
It's interesting because your five starters are going to make the team.
I hope so.
Logic says Colby Sorsdahl, Christian Mahogany, and Manu are also probably favored to make the team. That gives you eight right off the bat. Right. But Mahogany, Sorsdahl, and Manu are all kind of still developing. They're all six of, you know, day three picks because Manu was a fourth. But so that means if you're going to keep, and then if Dan Skipper is your nine, And is Coyote 10? And could, even if Coyote's 10, like, he still might be the best reserve that the yeah. Lions trust, right? Like, like he might be the guy that in week one, they, if they have to turn to someone, that's the guy they turn to. Yet he might be OL 10 for the long term, because you're in like this transition year where you're yep. really trying to develop the reserve offensive lineman for bigger roles. So I'm not concerned personally, because I like what I see and I enjoy offensive line play, and I see the upside in Sorsdell. I see, I, you know, from my draft studies, I liked what I saw in Mahogany. Again, we haven't seen him with pads on, so it's, or same with Manu. We haven't seen him with pads on yet, so it's hard to tell, but I like the upside. Right. I also hope the starting five stay very healthy. okay. I had another question about Broderick Martin, since we're talking about trenches. Carl Gusecki says, can you speak on the development of Broderick Martin? What do coaches need to see before he's considered an NFL caliber starter? Can you talk about what lower pad level means? And when we hear about his athletic prowess, I'd like to know what's keeping him off the field. Is it just his technique is bad? So again, I want to preface this with the caveat that we haven't seen him in pads in the spring. So it's impossible to really put a finger on what he's done from a developmental standpoint at this stage. What I can say is what the latter half questions here from Carl. Lower pad level means he's not getting low enough. Keep in mind, he's a 6'5" defensive tackle, but he has to be able to bend to get low in order to engage with power properly. If he stands straight up, which is what he was doing in the latter parts of training camp, it's a lot easier for offensive linemen who are lower to get under him and then leverage him off of his spot, you know, even though he's incredibly strong. So when they talk about lower pad level, they're talking shoulder pads. Okay. What you want is you want your shoulder pads dipped down and lower so that they can engage either at level with your offensive lineman or even lower than offensive lineman. And if you can get under that offensive lineman, you can gain a leverage advantage. And so that's what they're talking about. From an athletic prowess standpoint, you're talking about his foot movement. You're talking about his hand placement, which is a work in progress as well. That was another thing. He didn't have great hand placement as a rookie last year. And so, but athletically, he moves very fluidly, especially when going laterally. So if there's a outside run, he can move laterally to get to a spot. He's strong enough to power guys out of the way. So when you talk about like upside and what you're seeing out of Broderick and why why people think he can be a quality player in the NFL is because of how he moves, how his feet stay under him, the power he has, the size he has, all of those things are in his favor. It is his technique though. It's keeping his shoulders lower, bending his hips, sinking his hips a little bit more, yet maintaining his power. It's hand placement, understanding where to engage, where to throw punches first in order to create leverage and distance. Like, those are things that he's still developing. So we don't know where he's developed. We don't know how he's developed, but those are things that would need to improve before he's going to be able to be on the field consistently. Do you want to add anything to that?
I'll answer the question via Terrell Williams, the new defensive line coach, because he was asked specifically, what does Broderick Martin have to work on this spring to get to a point where, yeah, he can be a starter. He's not going to be a starter, obviously, over DJ Reader, right, but as a rotational guy, a significant rotational guy. And he says, hitting the sled, constantly working with him on his pad level and doing other things. The one thing that you didn't mention is arm length. He's got 35-inch arms.
Yeah.
Or just under 35-inch arms. Terrell Williams says 35 inch, which I think the technical 34 3/8, which is in the 74th percentile. So very long arms. And so he basically says it's got 35 inch arms or something crazy like that. He's just got to learn how to use them violently.
Mm-hmm.
So again, like you said, hand usage, pad level. Those are the two main things right now for him, I think.
A lot of times with defensive linemen, especially interior defensive linemen, nose tackles that are getting double teamed, they will come out of their stance with both hands moving forward because they're trying to initiate they're throwing their power.
Right.
When you have 35 inch hands, arms, it's almost better. Hands would be nuts, but it's almost better to throw one and then angle your body because then the offensive lineman cannot reach you, right? Because they can't overcome that 35, especially on the interior. Like the guards and the centers don't have 35 inch. They just don't. It's not conducive for an offensive lineman to have arm length that long because they have to stay bent. They have to, when they pass protect, they need to have a little bit shorter arms so that they can stay bent and then they can engage and they can throw based on the defensive lineman's movement. So you never see offensive linemen with very large arm length. Like for example, the longest arms on the interior for the Lions is Graham, who has 33 and a half, and you know what I mean? So right off the bat, Broderick has a distance advantage that he can use. And when you learn to throw your initial hits differently, you can create distance. And so if he wants to stay clean, and there's ways to do that, but to be able to throw from a low spot, it can be challenging for some of these big guys. And so that's kind of what Broderick, I think, is going through. All right. Next question. This is from D-Man. He wants to know, is Jack Campbell at the mic exclusively? So at OTAs, was he at the mic pretty much the whole time?
As far as I can remember, I believe the answer was yes. Now, part of that could be that Alex Anzalone was not there for all of OTAs. I believe he was only there for minicamp, the 3 days of minicamp. And so they used that time. I know they used that time to just hammer mic reps in. Not that Alex Anzalone was taking mic reps. We've established that he's that the Lions like him much better at the will. Mm-hmm. But I think the Lions use that opportunity not only to use Jack Campbell the mic, but have him kind of be the green dot play caller type things, because that is something that Alex Anzalone still normally does at the will spot.
Correct.
So as far as I can remember, the answer is yes. I think the plan is that he's kind of taking over that job from Derek Barnes. Now, that's not to say that Derek Barnes didn't get some reps at Mike. He did, but I think in those instances, it was just like, we have two linebackers on the field. Let's rotate who gets those mic reps. But for the majority of the first team reps, he was there. And when they did have all three guys out there, Barnes was kind of more in that Samish kind of role.
I think Barnes' flexibility allows him, and the fact that he's more experienced, allows him to be utilized in different positions. Whereas Jack, I think, is the future at Mike for them, the future green dot. And so it's not surprising to me that they're going to try and use that as many opportunities as they can in training camp to make sure that he's getting that position down.
I mean, that was their vision from day one. They came out and told us, right?
Right. And then there's going to be times, though, when things could be different. And we talked about this. Okay, so for the people who subscribe to POD Direct, the newsletter, we did a whole big hour-long thing on Brian Branch. And in that Brian Branch breakdown, we pointed to the fact that Derek Barnes was at the SAM against the Bucks. And then we have to we talked about the fact that it was flipped the game after against San Fran.
Right.
Derek Barnes was more in the mic, and then Jack was more at the SAM. I still think that's going to be relevant, right?
Yeah.
I still think there's going to be times when they want to be able to move the two guys in between. But for the most part, I do think Jack's going to be at the mic more this season because that is the long term, and especially in training camp as well.
Yeah, and I think even if like what you say is true, like he'll get some Sam reps here and there. I think the idea in the spring is just, like so much of what you do in the spring is mental based. It's not the physical work you're putting in; it's the mental work. And so I think the idea is get Jack Campbell as many mic reps as you can because that's the long term plan. Because that's him coordinating the defense, being the play caller, and you have to have that kind of level of knowledge of all the linebacker positions to even play that position to know, hey, when the guy, you know, when the offense sends this guy in motion, you move here, you move there. That's what he was doing all of spring camp. That's what they were really trying to hammer home for.
Yep. All right. Look, I wanted to try and keep this about an hour. I think we're about at an hour. And so I'm going to make that our last question. And I, like I said, at the top, I'm going to have more of these questions on a podcast with Joe, and we'll see. There's a lot of them. I'm probably going to put some more into written mailbags as well. So I appreciate you helping me sort through some of this OTA stuff that I didn't get a chance to look at, answer some questions.
Sure.
We are hoping to have some good news on several fronts from the POD standpoint in the next coming weeks. So keep an eye on POD and social media and stuff like that. We're going to hopefully have some good news on how we're growing as a site. And so pay attention to that. But thank you. Thanks, Jeremy, for joining me. And until next time, let's go Lions.